We go now to hear a presentation by our own Heidi Bogosian. Heidi spoke at an event sponsored by station affiliate WSLR in Sarasota. As the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild, Heidi had coordinated and organized legal observers during the Republican National Convention in Tampa and the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte. While in Florida, Heidi delivered a talk about the eroding civil rights of protesters during national special security events, pre-event surveillance, and tactical strategies deployed by police. Let's have a listen.
We have the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. I believe your 75th anniversary was pretty recently. The NLG is a storied organization. It is a principled organization, and I am not the right person to give you the details of their history, except to say that we are privileged to have their national executive director with us and to get an insight as to what can be done about the RNC and the various protest activities there. And for that, Heidi Bogosian.
It's truly an honor to be here. This is the first time I've visited one of Law and Disorder's affiliate stations. And I love your space. It's just really a thrill for me. The Guild is celebrating its 75th year, and I want to just say that over the years, we have worked very closely with many ACLU chapters around the country. In California especially, we often litigate together. And in the wake of 9/11, we came together on a number of efforts, so we value that relationship. I want to share what we have found to be a formula that has worked well for government agencies and for corporations seeking to rebrand modern-day protest and activism. Anyone in this room who has seen local news coverage of the RNC is already familiar with one large component of that formula. Today's news websites and newspapers are full of alarming headlines, all citing a single FBI and DHS intelligence bulletin. The bulletin is for internal law enforcement use. It doesn't appear on the FBI or Department of Homeland Security websites, but it somehow made its way into major newsrooms around the country. In it, federal intelligence officers warn that protesters are planning to close the Tampa Bay bridges and might try to use improvised explosive devices. They warn that anarchists could block roads, use acid-filled eggs to protest the convention, one headline reads. And I just got an email from one of my colleagues who's setting up our legal office in Tampa. Apparently, there's a new headline saying that police found bricks, pipes, and other, quote, suspicious items on a roof about a mile from the convention center. There was apparently a little graffiti that they attribute to anarchists, and so they're concerned, and this is now a headline story. We've seen this before the other RNCs in New York. There were full-page tabloid stories proclaiming that violent anarchists were coming to town. They even published a list of names of the 50 leading anarchists, several of whom I know to be wonderful, peaceful activists who have committed their lives to changing some policies that we disagree with. But this is the first part of the formula, and it's a formula that the Guild, and I'm sure many of you are aware of, media portrayal of protesters as violent anarchists. Stories in 2008 in the RNC in St. Paul highlighted raids of activist houses there based on anonymous tips. What we find is that rarely does the mainstream press follow up on those colorful, provocative headlines weeks or months later, when it turns out the charges were dropped, that the household items that were found during a raid, bottles of bleach, old rags, were really just ordinary objects like those found on the rooftop today that many of us have, to which police ascribes evil intent. Nor do reporters, as often as they might, examine the social justice issues that the unions, anti-war groups, environmental groups, and so many others are trying to bring to the forefront at the RNC. It's worth noting that the U.S. Press Freedom Rating dropped 27 places to number 47 in the world, due in large part to the police response to Occupy, which received a lot of coverage for overreaching police tactics. The second part of the equation that we've seen, especially since the WTO protest in 1999 in Seattle, is aggressive, unconstitutional policing tactics. Preemptive policing, where the police will opt, instead of isolating one or two troublemakers who may break the law, instead of isolating and arresting them, they will conduct large, what we call trap and arrests, where they will encircle hundreds of people and arrest them without probable cause, detaining them often for days so that they are, in effect, kept off the streets during the RNC or the DNC and out of sight of the delegates. The Occupy events over this past year have helped shine a spotlight on those practices that we feel have been gaining momentum for years, but have not always been captured in the media or resonated as strongly in the public eye as they did when, for example, at the beginning of Occupy in New York, police sprayed pepper spray directly into a passive protester's eyes. Over the past year, we saw trap and arrest. 700 individuals were, we believe, led, and this is in court now, but we believe the evidence will show that the police gave indication to the protesters at an early Occupy Wall Street event that they were allowed to proceed on the car way of the Brooklyn Bridge. All of a sudden, orders to disperse were given, which only the few people at the beginning of the march could hear, and then they were all arrested. And guild members have gone forward with a class action lawsuit on that case. We've seen, as you know, the deployment of expensive police equipment, often military in nature, tanks, which I know Tampa has, used to intimidate protesters, often highlighted in the news so that people who may never have exercised their First Amendment right, but who want to come out to a political convention will say, look at those tanks and the body armor and all the tear gas they're bringing in. We think it has a chilling effect on free speech in that it not only intimidates people when they're on the ground, but precludes many from coming. In New York, we saw helicopters deployed to hover over marches of 20 people at Occupy Wall Street. We saw a constant maze of barricades erected around Wall Street. We saw journalists and city council members pushed blocks away while they showed their ID, and in many cases arrested to keep them from observing police protester interactions. We saw the overcharging to keep police in custody for longer than they ordinarily would have been held on misdemeanor charges. We saw false alerts that threats existed to police officer safety. We saw the photographing of disorderly conduct arrestees and other offenses for which individuals are usually not photographed, if they're even put through the system. And we saw extended detention for people who refused to have so-called voluntary iris scans. That's a new procedure they're using in New York. Allegedly, they say, to prevent individuals from escaping. We believe it's to amass yet another kind of data bank on politically active individuals. Throughout all of these instances, over months of intense police presence at Occupy Wall Street, we saw what we've seen at national special security events around the country for years. Police department with a primary objective of clearing the streets, frightening people, and then dealing with the consequences of police breaking the law down the road, often after people are put through the system and had to come back if they were from out of town at their own expense for court hearings. In a disturbing trend, we see officers disregarding the law and setting as a priority the monitoring of political events instead of responding to ordinary crimes that may be happening at a given moment. We asked officers at Union Square in New York a few months ago when they started enacting a midnight curfew that had never been imposed, because it's a very open park with entrances on all sides so that people who live on either side can walk through rather than take the long route around. So they started imposing a midnight curfew and cleaning the park, hosing it down with big trucks, which they'd never done. But we asked one officer why hundreds of officers in riot gear, and he just said it's a priority now. We've also witnessed what I think is a third component of our equation, and it's really the one that informs the first two, the media, the excessive use of force, is spying and infiltration by the government and by corporations who are often the targets of protest. In New York, Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan Chase are funding massive surveillance operations, which in the wake of Occupy introduce new fears of selective policing based on the content of the message. We witness the impact of government and corporate spying during the Occupy movement, and we continue to see the impact at NSSE events like the RNC. The intelligence report citing anarchist threats could well be based on such innocuous information as activist flyers or websites that are commonly spread weeks or months before the convention, containing constitutionally protected First Amendment speech, politically rhetorical speech, such as shut down the convention. Made public at the height of Occupy was the extent to which big business does partner with public law enforcement, not just in spying, but in handing over bankrolls of money to support public police initiatives. In one New York lawsuit brought on behalf of Occupy protesters, the plaintiffs alleged that private corporations played a key role in curtailing their free speech. An agreement was formed between the City of New York, the Transit Authority, the mayor, Police Commissioner Ray Kelly, along with JP Morgan, Brookfield Properties, which was in charge of the park where the Occupy encampment was, to basically deprive protesters of their right to access public spaces that were on the private property. So in exchange for, say, Chase building a building of a very high, tall building, they would say when they struck the agreement, we'll make this a public park in front. The complaint alleged the banks and the police department denied access to that public space at 1 Chase Manhattan Plaza because shortly after the police barricades were removed, a private fence was erected. Documents obtained by the National Lawyers Guild through FOIA requests do confirm vast monitoring, surveillance, and information sharing between the Department of Homeland Security and local authorities all around the country in response to Occupy. And we know that this is going on all different levels. We obtained documents in partnership with the DC-based group, the Partnership for Civil Justice, and Michael Moore. Heavily redacted, they still suggest a massive spying network exists, supported, as you may know, by anti-terrorism funding, which is very attractive to local police departments, because if they can identify terrorist threats locally, they can apply for funding to bolster their equipment and their police forces. In a case you might have heard about where the New York District Attorney subpoenaed the tweets of an individual arrested on that mass arrest on the Brooklyn Bridge, a Guild member, Martin Stoller, just filed a civil suit to block disclosure of the tweets, even though the judge said it was permissible because they had been out in the public, based on the fact that they would also reveal 3 months of geographic contact information during that period to show where that individual had been tweeting from. The activist in this case, Malcolm Harris, who's a writer in Brooklyn, likened the request to surveillance, saying that the tweets are public except when they're accumulated in that fashion. As you know, government agencies target the leaders of political movements. They've even used snatch squads at RNCs, and they've even snatched legal observers for the Guild at the FTAA ministerial protest years ago by coming up in a van, and police with black masks literally took Miles Swanson, one of our young legal observers, whose picture had been put in a PowerPoint presentation that local law enforcement showed to local businesses a couple of weeks before. And as I think is happening in Tampa, there's been some closing down of businesses for several days during this week. It's part of the fear-mongering. You need to shutter everything up to avoid having your windows smashed. We see the targeting not only of leaders, mentioning of legal observers, which we've heard from two members here that in presentations by law enforcement, they were mentioned that we are friends of anarchists, but employing grand juries to search for evidence of political affiliation, which is improper, to have visits by the FBI weeks or months in advance of these events around the country when they've identified activists who they think will be traveling, and they question them about, why are you going? Who else is going? We set up a hotline when the FBI announced that environmental and animal rights activists were the number one domestic terrorism threat back in 2004. we call it the Green Scare Hotline, but now we use it for general FBI visits. So when activists are called, we advise them, don't talk to them, get a lawyer, don't give them any information, and of course, don't lie to them. When movements such as ours become casualties of government and corporate spying and disruption, civic trust is undermined, vital political debates are stifled, and as you know, there are far-reaching societal consequences for us all. As the world's superpower, this nation wields major influence on other countries. We feel that by punishing domestic dissenters, the U.S. sends a signal to others that we no longer cherish the First Amendment. And we see countries around the globe mirroring at times our version of the war on terrorism by prosecuting their own political opponents, religious groups, and separatists. At the Guild, when we speak, we encourage people not to be afraid of these tactics, of this formula, which is based on the so-called Miami model. We must continue to ignite anger in the hearts and minds of Americans and not let people slip into complacency. If we allow campaigns of disinformation, such as the things we're seeing in the media this week, taking household objects and making it sound as though we have terrorist homemade bombs, if we allow that to continue, we become complicit in the horrors perpetrated in the name of big business and the national security state. As Occupy Wall Street gained momentum in what we think was perhaps the single largest surge of protests since the Vietnam War, and as protesters traveled to Chicago and now Tampa and Charlotte, police and local government's response reflects growing animosity toward activism in general. In sharp contrast, the many creative forms of protest that occupiers engaged in, their encampments from the very small to large that sprung to life, fostered a sense of community and creative dissent that has so long been missing in this country. I think we owe a debt of gratitude to the thousands of individuals who joined to make the Occupy movement and the protesters coming here this week. We owe them a debt of gratitude because they serve as a wake-up call for the rest of the country and hopefully for the rest of the world. Thank you.
That was our own Heidi Boghossian at an event sponsored by our affiliate, WSLR in Sarasota. If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.